You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our guest now is an Anglican bishop, and an Anglican bishop from perhaps one of the most troubled provinces in the world, from Rwanda. The Right Reverend Alexis Belinda Bagabo is an Anglican bishop in Gahini in Rwanda. Bishop Alexis, welcome to Sunday night.
Thank you so much, John.
Bishop, you've come out of a country which the world associates with one thing these days, that's tragedy and horror. Were you personally involved? Where were you when so many people died in Rwanda in 10 days? I think almost a million people died.
Thank you, John. I was in Rwanda and I was on the hit list, and actually so many attempts to kill me were made. Fortunately, the story is confined in my book, Rescued by Angels. I survived. And since then, I've been working very hard to really make a difference, to help the orphans and to help in the process of reconciliation. And allow me to probably just mention that today we have gone a long way, 13 years down the road. For your information, Kigali, the capital, is considered to be the most peaceful city of Africa. So we have gone a long way. Rwanda is no longer a country which is really troubled, but it's a country which is rebuilding and which is working very hard towards reconciliation and peace.
Where were you when trouble struck, and how personally did it affect you?
Yes, when trouble started, I was in Rwanda, and I was in Gahini Diocese. That is a different diocese from where I am now. I was assistant bishop by then. And I was caught, you know, there were roadblocks everywhere, so there was no possibility of running away. So I was there and I waited because I had nowhere to hide. And so many attempts, you know, the militia would come to kill me and then they'd just go away. It went on and on and on, and they couldn't kill me, and I survived. So this is it.
You say that very matter-of-factly, but you must have seen things in that period that shocked you. And for how long did it go on? Like, for how long were you in genuine fear for your life?
I mean, actually, not really. I mean, it was, in fear, but I was really waiting for death because I knew I was going to be killed for sure. And as a matter of fact, my relatives, my father, my mother, my brother, my sister, cousins, they were all killed, and even our property destroyed. So this went on for 3 months. In exactly 100 days, so many people, close to a million people were killed. And there was, I was, in fact, believe me, John, at the age of 39, I wrote my will. So you understand what it means. When you sit down and you write your will, it's because you know for sure you're going to die. So, and when I was expecting myself to be in heaven, I found myself in Congo alive. This is it. And here I am.
So those who expect the good things inevitably get responsibility cast upon them.
Yes, exactly. You know, I mean, it's very strange because you see, it's like waking up after a nightmare, and you don't even believe that you are really alive. You just have to wait for a while. You say, "Am I alive? Yes, I am alive." Mm. I'm still even now doubting, really, but I know I'm alive.
How many of your immediate family were killed?
Oh goodness! I even sometimes fear to count them. They were really very many. As I told you, my father, my mother, and my brother, and my brother's children, another brother. There are many, and cousins, you know, so many. They were really, you know, they were killed, them all.
The way it's represented to us in the West, even 13 years later, is as a conflict essentially between two groups, the minority Tutsi group, who had power and were in charge, and the majority Hutu group, who felt disempowered and disenfranchised and felt the need to strike back. Yet even this is something of a caricature, because when one explores this even a little deeply, one finds that the boundaries between Hutu and Tutsi are somewhat problematic anyway, and largely a construction of geographers and ethnographers in the 1920s and 1930s.
My friend, I think it's clear. I mean, sometimes when people just talking about the two, you know, the ethnic, you know, clashes and fighting, it's rubbish. It's a case whereby you have some dictators who are greedy, who want to maintain themselves on power, playing one group against the other. That's all. It's something which is really a political problem, and they make it an ethnic problem. Today, John, if you come to Rwanda and you are looking for Hutus and Tutsi, you'll be surprised because you won't find even them. We all look alike, we speak the same language, we all live mixed with each other. But very unfortunately, in the process of dividing and ruling, the Belgium had introduced ethnic identity cards with ethnic mention. So you had to display your identity, and whenever you said you didn't have it, you'll be killed anyway.
But and even that ethnicity back then was largely artificial, based on things like how many cattle you owned.
I mean, exactly, because
it wasn't
they didn't
a case
know.
Of a real ethnic identity.
It was terrible because, you know, I mean, somehow whoever had more than 10 cows, because at that time the cows were the sign of the wealth. So whoever had more than 10 cows was simply just said to be a Tutsi. Those who had less than 10 cows were said to be Hutus. It's very strange because beforehand, even two blood brothers could belong to different ethnic groups.
So how is it that such depth of hatred can manifest itself so quickly on such a shallow base?
No, I mean, it's not really quickly because, you know, I mean, this is, we are talking about 1935. And believe me, Rwandese are not a queer, you know, sort of kind of human being, you know, type of human beings. We are wonderful people already, I tell you. The only trouble is that any human being put under the same circumstances as we went through, we'll just come up with the same results. Because what happened is that, you see, right from 1935, there were some writings, you know, teaching people how we are different. And then when it came to 1960, for the first time in our history, and we had been living together for centuries, there was these so-called ethnic clashes. And then from 1990, there was intensive teaching day in and day out, and the teaching using the radio, using the media, the radio meetings, you know, every possibility, which everything was used to intensify, you know, the hatred.
Were you classified as Tutsi or Hutu?
Myself, I was classified as a Tutsi. Unfortunately, I think by then my grandfather had a lot of cows. I would imagine. In fact, I know. So I was put on the category of the Tutsis.
Did you know people who, and you still know people who were involved as the killers, as Hutu, people that you grew up with? And
Man, I tell you, even those who killed my father and my mother, I know them personally. We grew up together. I know them.
How do you feel about them now?
Oh, how do I feel about them? Let me tell you something. And this is the beauty of being a Christian, because, you know, if I wasn't a Christian, I would find it very difficult. But when I consider myself as a forgiven sinner, now, when I look at myself as a forgiven sinner, because I feel that it's extremely difficult, why I love God, why I love Jesus, is because those things which I cannot do, He helps me to do them. I just have to go to them, to Him, and cry and say, I can't forgive these people. Give me the heart of forgiveness. You know, enable me to forgive, and it becomes much more easier.
Have you spoken to any of these people personally?
In fact, recently, before I came here, I had a clear voice of even forgiving. You know, sometimes they are told to, you know, like to pay back the things they have destroyed. But these guys, some of them are so poor But I felt God compelling me to tell them not to pay anything, simply to know that killing is bad, because I want to leave the legacy behind me, not of revenge or making someone to pay back or whatever. I want to be seen as a person who is forgiving. Because, I mean, a simple poor peasant to pay me, I mean, I have far more. In fact, I should be helping him. So I feel pity for them. So I'm sure when I go back, I'll be talking them to them. Because of this new dimension, I felt God was telling me, tell them that you have been blessed, so they don't need to pay anything. I have some surviving relatives who are really very keen on making them pay at least some property they destroyed,
yes.
But they are too poor to do that. So I'll plead their cause and tell them that that one we can forgive as well. If we have forgiven them to have killed our relatives, we can even easily let it go and forgive about the things they destroyed, because they are poor, even these guys. And they are so afraid and they are so shaken. And we have to, this circle of violence has to be broken.
You have to have some larger vision. I mean, hope is a very powerful emotion, but it's built on things that have to do with some sense of the future and some sense of possibility. Vengeance is a much more immediate emotion. Vengeance, in some ways, can see an object of immediate satisfaction in front of it. This must be a hard thing to sell, hope over vengeance.
I tell you, you have to be. Recently, I spent 2 weeks in Sri Lanka, where they are undergoing a very difficult moment, and I told them that you have to look at greater good, and you have to have a very strong heart, and only the strong can offer the hand of peace, because you are not shaken. Now, reconciliation, peace, the hand of peace is offered by somebody who is strong in his heart, or because the weak, the arm of the weak, is violence. So I think the other thing is that we have to think seriously about the future. Where do we leave our children? How do I leave this world? Do I leave it in a better place than I found it, or do I destroy it, and then at the end of the day, I have destroyed myself and I leave nothing but hatred to my children. I don't want that. Having lived through problems and suffering for 40 years, through ethnic discrimination, I want my children to have a better life. And I'll do anything to make sure that my children are not surrounded by hatred and fightings and greed and all sort of. I want to give them something to live for, something good, something higher.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, the Bishop of Kahini in Rwanda, the Right Reverend Alexis Bulindabago. Thank you. a musical selection of our guest, the Anglican Bishop of Gahini in Rwanda, the Right Reverend Alexis Belindabago. Bishop Alexis, let me talk to you about another paradox. You've mentioned the year 1935 as one of those years which began the separation between the Tutsi and the Hutu, when government agents began to make ethnic distinctions between people, no matter how thin the basis. But that year is associated with something else. It's associated with a great Christian revival. The East African revival was centred on Rwanda. And for many years, Rwanda was regarded as a sort of the heart of Christian virtue in the centre of Africa. Is this something of a problem? But how does one explain the paradox?
John, that is a real paradox, and I think I am the right person to ask that question, because I live exactly at the very place where the East African Revival Movement started. And for your information, in August, we are organizing another big crusade. We'll be having between 10,000 and 15,000 people for 5 days, because we believe that what God did was real, and we need it to happen again so that it may spread and change the hearts of people. But you know what? When God is at work, the devil is at work again. And sometimes when we don't persist and persevere in what we are doing and we fall asleep, I jokingly tell people that at the time of the genocide, when the rest of the population were asleep in the darkness, the church leaders were asleep in the light. So it's so easy for the church to fall asleep in the light and forget their responsibilities. But in actual fact, this movement did not really touch the majority in the leadership, because those in leadership were predominantly Roman Catholics. And this movement was especially among the Protestants, the Anglicans, especially, that's where it started, and then it spread among the Protestants. And
so it was essentially a Protestant revival in a predominantly Roman Catholic country.
Yeah, that's what happened. But the church, you know, the Anglican church has been growing steadily. Right now, we're claiming out of 8 million, we have now more than a million people. So the church has been growing steadily. But again, you see, as you can imagine, there is no better place for revenge for the devil except where he has been hit hard. I think the choice for, you know, for the devil was really quite appropriate.
Have church leaders discussed this among themselves across those boundaries? I mean, do Protestants and Catholic leaders get together and discuss what happened and their responsibility in that, given that the country has a strong Christian heritage?
Yeah, we discuss these things. You know, we discuss these things, and sometimes we, it's not easy. There are certain things which we reach, and we don't want to accuse, you know, to point an accusing finger to each, you know, to each other. Because of diplomacy, because of this and that, respect for each other. But we don't even want to dwell on who did what, who didn't do what or what, but we are focusing on what we can do together. That's what we are focusing on. So failures, we share the failure. We don't want to shift the guilt to anybody else. We share the failure. Because
it's got to be a great failure on the part of the church, though, hasn't it?
It is true. We have to confess. It's the whole trouble of nominalism. When you get people who are just churchgoers, what I call the four wheel Christians. You know, those who come to be baptized and to be married and to be buried. They really don't mean business, and they are not transformed by the gospel. And you know, even though there was the revival movement, it is spread. But somehow, towards the 50s, there was a, you know, the movement was not really serious. It didn't continue to grow steadily as it should. So somehow there was a lot of nominalism within the church. Mm. Every single church. I don't want to single out a particular church and say, okay, these are the ones to blame. But today we are saying, okay, we have, we have not done what we should have done, and we don't want to be, you know, just less clever than a donkey and stumble on the same stone several times. That's why we are working very hard towards peace and reconciliation.
It goes towards a question that churches are commonly find themselves in difficulties over. That is this whole issue of judgment and reconciliation. The churches are often set up by civil society, in fact, as the sort of moral guardians. Yet there's a sense in which if the church is to be true to itself, the church has in some way to acknowledge that sin is within its structures as well. And that's a very difficult thing.
Yes, we have to. You see, somebody said that God put the church in the world to be the light, and the devil put the world into the church to be the darkness. And you know, it comes a time whereby the prophetic voice of the church is silenced. And then that church becomes a reflection of the society it's operating in. So this happens often, whereby you find that the very evils which are just happening in the society in general are present in the church. In that case, then the church stops being actually the solution to the problem, because she becomes part of the problem. And this is what had happened in Rwanda. You talk about ethnic discrimination outside; it was happening in the church. You talk about corruption outside; it was happening within the church. So the church had stopped, in some ways, to be part of the solution, but she was part of the problem.
How does the church recover itself?
It's just repentance. It's very easy. It's just repentance. We say, okay, we've fallen short of the glory of God, and you've got to repent. Because, you know, the biblical teaching doesn't change. You know, we are the people who change, but the biblical model, the biblical teaching doesn't change. And actually, the message of repentance is always true. And actually, what happened is that those of us... But generally speaking, let me tell you something which is forgotten. There are very many faithful Christians who risked their lives, who never killed, but who risked their life to try to hide those who were being hunted. Just to give you an example, we were two bishops in the same diocese. I was assistant bishop. Now, the diocesan bishop, who was a Hutu himself, and his wife, we didn't have problems, you know, among ourselves. He didn't betray me. If anything, he was crying. His heart was crying because, you know, he did not believe, really, that he was a Hutu. We both considered ourselves as children of God. But, you know, when the killing machine is set in motion and the government is behind it with the army, with all the weapons, what do you do? So the forgotten part of the Rwandese tragedy is those faithful Rwandese who never killed because of their faith. And they were there. And I remember some young people who were sending messages who said, our parents have killed, but because of our faith, and they have looted things, and we don't want to eat food which has been looted by our parents. And they were seeking advice. You know, it's like just the Corinthian, you know, just debate about food, you know, offered to the idols. And these are Hutu young men, believers, who felt that not only they shouldn't kill, but also they shouldn't even eat the food which has been looted from the Batutsi. So this is the other side which is forgotten. And this is the product of the true revival, and this is what we want as a true revival.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. My guest, the Right Reverend Alexis Belindabago, the Bishop of Gahini in Rwanda.
Yeah.
John Cleary with you, my guest, the Right Reverend Belinda Bagabo, on Sunday night. Bishop Alexis, let's talk about your part of your mission here to Australia. I want to talk about two things. You in Rwanda said about doing your little part in the healing of the country with the setting up of a foundation for young people, Let Them Live Foundation, a foster care agency for orphans of the genocide. To what extent is that owned by the church in Rwanda, and to what extent do you rely on outside assistance to keep Let Them Live alive?
Thank you. I think when I started that agency, in fact, I had to even move a bit for 3 years, move out of the structure to make sure that it was an independent. Because you see, the tendency is to make a proselyte those we are assisting. And I had to desist that, you know, that I had to say, okay, I want something which, you know, to help the orphans because they need our help. And but we get quite a lot of support from the church, because even the church had to set me free to be able to do that job. And, you know, we're getting quite some good support from Australia. And, in fact, I have to, John, let me tell you the good news is that, you see, that is a venture which we did together. And I need really Australians to keep on supporting that agency, because the seed money, the $5,000 we used to start that program came from Australia. I didn't even know. I met somebody, he told me this is an address. But it is an organization called Anglicode. They are the ones who send me the $5,000. I didn't even know them before. And the $5,000 became like the five loaves of bread and fish. God multiplied them. And today we have been able to assist 15,000 orphans. And we have some good, faithful Australians who are giving some support. And I would encourage many more to support, because a dollar, when it is properly used, can take people a long way. And this is what we do, to be able to achieve more by using less.
How many young people would have come through your hands?
15,000. 15,000. I mean, there are those who are still being helped. There are those who have grown up. But as we are looking, those who we could be having in the program today would be like 6,000-7,000. But in total, those who went through our program, officially, there are those we are supporting, but whom we did not necessarily register. You know, this is an on-off gift kind of thing. But those who had a continuous support of some kind was 15,000.
It seems an enormous number to deal with, in terms of being able to be assured that you would be able to deal with them in a satisfactory manner, in a manner which will help them. It must require a large number of people involved in caring for such a vast number of children. This is a very labour-intensive activity.
Yeah, it is, but we have a lot of volunteers. For instance, like now, we avoided the traditional orphanages, which are very expensive, which are contrary to our tradition. So we opted and we campaigned for the model of the foster care program, whereby children are placed with foster parents, and then you support them in a family setup. And this has been going on, and we have very many volunteers inside the country, and obviously very many volunteers outside who are assisting us, you know, who are assisting to make it happen.
And they assist in financial ways.
In financial, you know, yeah. Financially, we get people who are just putting some support, like Anglicode, like ORAF, and potentially others who might be willing to really do something, either through these agencies or even directly.
One of the agencies, of course, that you are working with here in Australia, and one of the groups that have brought you here this time, is the MICA Challenge, which takes the whole issue of development to a larger stage again. So you not only have interest in your own country, you're actually promoting a way of looking at the world.
You see, the thing is, one of the things which I can really say that I'm happy with is that I look at things globally. I feel myself as a citizen of the world. I told you in a while that you know, I only spend 4 days, you know, from Sri Lanka. I spend 2 hectic weeks trying to, you know, to t- teach people about peace building and peace and reconciliation, and bringing the message of hope to politicians, to church leaders, to religious leaders, to peace activists, to, you know, to business community, you know, to the various people. Because I feel that if these guys are not helped, they may kill each other, as we did. I told them that we made three mistakes, and the price was very heavy. Now they have made 2.5. And their price may be even heavier than ours because there's a religious dimension in their case. Now, coming this way, I came under the invitation of Mica Challenge. And for your information, I'm the chairman of Mica Challenge Rwanda. And Mica Challenge, actually, you know, we sometimes spend a lot of time dealing with the symptoms. While with Mica Challenge, we are really joining hands with the government, the world government, who promised that they are going to work very hard and make sure that by the year 2015, the Millennium Development Goals, their 8 set up, they're achieved. And we say, oh, this is wonderful. It sounds like the gospel. So we said, what an opportunity. We need to remind them. And we said that we can just work through our network, our churches, our various agencies, and, you know, help in the realization of these Millennium Development Goals.
The Millennium Development Goals, of course, were the subject of some discussion in the last couple of weeks with the G8 meeting. And Bob Geldof, one of those who has been pushing very hard from the Western point of view for some real grappling by Western nations with the problems faced by Africa in particular, was very, very angry, disappointed and angry with what he felt was simply lip service played by the leaders of Western countries. And in fact, they haven't even honoured the agreements they'd made not a couple of years before in a previous meeting of the G8. Do you feel some of that frustration as well, that leaders are only too willing under public pressure in the West to make all sorts of commitments about debt forgiveness, but when it comes to delivery on substantial aid, which does involve real money, they're not so ready to come forth?
That's quite true. But it's quite true. They have not really come to where they should be. You know, they promised, but they're not delivering. But myself, I will not say that I'm very, very angry. I'll simply say that let's not lose hope. Let's gently keep on pushing and pushing and driving the point home. And John, I think, you know, we, being part of the voters, we can always look at those people who are willing to make, you know, this world a better place to live in. Because what is the point of keeping poverty, which can be eradicated? Because one day I was telling people that it doesn't help to keep the poor nations in that state, because you get a lot of refugees running away from poverty, and they come to just to disturb your peace. And it doesn't help to keep the world into a less secure situation. You are not even helping yourself.
What do you say to those people, and there are many of them still, who say, look, it's pointless giving aid to African countries until they show they are transparent in their governance, that one of the great problems of economic underdevelopment in the 60s and 70s and 80s was that aid went on a multilateral basis through various agencies into the hands of government and ultimately was corruptly dealt with, and it just went into lining the pockets of the elites.
I think, John, number one, you need to ask if these elite were not working in conjunction with some of those who were giving the money, because in any case, they knew that these people are corrupt. Now, I think if you really mean business and you want to do something, please tell those you mean business to come to me. I'll tell them how they can make a difference without risking their money, because there are very many channels. And again, there are many good examples whereby corruption is fought. There are systems which are put in place, which are, you know, of transparency. Let them start with those and then give an example how it pays to be transparent, to be clean. And believe me, if they really mean business, there are very many places where they can start. You don't solve the problems overnight. But if you start and concentrate on those who are showing that they are really very cooperative, I believe you can achieve a lot. Secondly, those of us who are in those countries, I think we are very much willing to take our countries to task and tell them now, look here, this money is coming to do this. Are you using it? And that is the beauty of MICA challenge, because it's not one-way traffic. It is two-way traffic, whereby those who are here can remind the government what they have promised, and those of us who are over there, we can remind our governments that we have, you know, they have to honor their promises as well. So I think probably those are some lame excuses. If we really mean it, I think we can do it.
Do you sense, as you travel around, that not only is your work in Rwanda being recognised, but that the goals of organisations such as churches who promote the MICA challenge and other groups such as Bob Geldof and Bono and pop singers are reaching people seriously now, that this issue is not just something that's going to be there for a little while and then people will lose interest, but there's a real head of steam now that will continue on the whole action for proper development in the world?
John, I think something very interesting is happening. It is the first time in history, and you know, with the coming of globalization, I hear many people agonizing over it. But instead of agonizing, we should be organizing ourselves as churches, as parachurch organizations, as people of goodwill. If you organize ourselves, we can change things.
That's a very good line. There's a very good line. You ought to use that as a slogan. Don't agonize, organize.
Yeah, that's it. Because we can use, I mean, it's an opportunity for the first time. You know, I mean, believe me, you know, I was 2 weeks ago, I was in Asia. Last week, I was in Africa. Today, I'm in Australia. Next week, I could be in America. I mean, the world has become such a small... It's just one village whereby you can swing left or right. And I think we can use that opportunity to really convey the message. And it is possible.
What about within the Anglican Communion yourself? The African bishops represent a diversity of views. The Archbishop of South Africa is one who supports the Millennium Goals very strongly. He's been a great agent in that change, in that cause. The Archbishop of Nigeria, a different perspective again, yourself as a local bishop. Do you see the church in Africa, the Anglican Church in particular, having some sort of coherent vision about itself?
John, I think people are people, and we have to sometimes to agree to disagree on certain issues. But when it comes to other fundamental issues, then it's very clear. Because when it comes to the eradication of poverty, then we should all be agreeing. I don't think that there's any divergence. They have some doctrinal differences. But I don't think that as far as fighting poverty is concerned, I don't think they have any divergency. And again, even though I'm a local bishop, but I'm very close to these archbishops, and someday I could, you never know. But I'm very close, I follow very closely what is taking place in the communion. And I speak to various people, various bishops across the globe. So I know we all see things in the same way. There may be those who are not very, very actively engaged, as I am, and a few others are, and the one of South Africa is. But nevertheless, I think we see things in the same way. As far as fighting global poverty is concerned, we see things in the same way.
Bishop Belinda Bagabo, we'll take your message to heart. We thank you for joining us today. It's been
very
good
of you
to join us on Sunday night. We'll take that slogan away too. Don't agonise, organise. Very good. Archbishop Alexis of Gahini in Rwanda, the Right Reverend Alexis Belinda Bagabo. And we really should ask you finally, Bishop, before you go, you not only have the responsibility of diocesan leadership, you are also a husband and a father. How do your immediate family fit into this? Your wife, how does she share your burden here? Did she go through, well, naturally she went through those experiences with you. Did it affect your marriage? Did it affect your immediate relationship?
I tell you what, in fact, it has brought us together as a family. I tell you what I did. Number one, when I felt that God was calling me to minister to the orphans, to really go out to help the orphans, I had to consult my wife, who is a medical doctor. In fact, she even herself volunteered. When we started, for 3 years, both of us were working there. She was working as a medical doctor, helping the traumatized kids. But again, the other thing which I did, I went. By then, we had 4 children. Now we have 6 of our own, 9 under our roof, and thousands under our care, and they're all our children. But then the 4 children I had before I started that ministry, I went to them. I said, children, you know many children who don't have their parents, and their parents have been killed. They said, yes, we know. I said, are you willing to share your dad with other children? They said, of course, dad, yes. And I tell you, my kids, they have an open heart. And in fact, we have some rooms which are like dorms. So, you know, kids come and go. So it's an open home. If anything, they are helping me in my ministry. Wherever I go, I leave with them, you know, my program. So they know every time where I am, and they are praying for me. And when I go home, I have to give them the report. So they are part and parcel of my ministry. And believe me, it's not only the work among the orphans. I have 3 ministries of which I'm the founder. There's another ministry which is called Museko, which is doing evangelization, counseling, and reconciliation. And I'm on board of many others. So they are part and parcel of my ministry. If anything, this has really drawn us together. And the time we spend together is a very precious time. So it has affected positively my immediate family.
Bishop Alexis, it's been a very precious time with us this evening. Thank you very much for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you, and God bless you, John.